Our next speaker is Dr. Julie Freischlag, and Dr. Freischlag is Dean of the Wake Forest School of Medicine, as well as CEO of the Baptist Health System in North Carolina, based in Winston-Salem. Let me get your slides ready to go.
So I don't know how to follow a guy with snakes, but I think he just taught us something, right? Is that what the point was to do it? So all I know is that if I see a snake, I run. So I don't think I'll pay attention to what kind of snake it is. So my point of view today is really, as a CEO and dean, a little bit about looking at comparison to what we do with medical students, and also just a I took my boards. I've been on the board for 21 years. I was in giving board exams, and I still have a couple more years to go. And I was the sixth woman ever to get her VASCR board. And so when I went in to do my third recertification for vascular at a testing center, so I've gone through all of these where you went to testing centers and you actually had to do it at certain times. And I walked in, and the young woman sitting there, she goes, "Oh, my God, we were waiting to see what you looked like. We've never seen a third-time vascular surgery recertification person." And I was like, oh, boy. I felt like saying, "I'm here to take my SAT. Thank you very much." But so I'm from that old school where I've done it three times in general, three times in vascular, and did that in intense studying, which I actually sort of liked. I liked CSAP and VSAP. That was just sort of the nature of things, and I would spend, you know, a week or two studying and then go take the exam. And I must admit, I learned a lot from it, but you did have to book it. You had to take time off of practice. And I must admit, I think there were, I saw on that thing, these gotcha questions. I know for the VASCR board, this third-time recertification, for reasons that were a little unclear, it was the same exam that they were giving the first-time takers when I took my third-time recert. And there were stuff I didn't know on it, and I was a little nervous that I wasn't going to pass. And they've changed it also. It used to come in the mail, right, a little envelope saying you passed. Well, they don't do that anymore, and somehow I didn't pay attention. So I made my assistant go online to see if I passed because I was a little worried about it. And same with the general surgeon. I think there were some things on that that weren't applicable. But I must admit, after I finished that, because I've had to board certify in both because I give both exams still, I did learn stuff. So I think part of it is we do learn stuff when you go study and learn stuff. The key is how to get it done in a timely fashion and what do patients want you to do. So Mark sort of went over this, and where I sit overseeing, you know, a couple thousand physicians now in all specialties. And prior to that, being a chair of surgery for 11 years, overseeing hundreds of surgeons, when people don't check one box, they tend not to check them all. And so if they don't recertify, they tend to be a problem in the hospital. They tend to be irritating in the OR. They tend not to do anything. And so to me, I use recertification as a marker of a good physician. And it's similar to me a little bit in how we look at medical students. You know, why do we require them to get a really high step one course to get into surgery, right? Because if you look at step one, it has almost nothing to do with surgery on it, except they paid attention to the rules, they study really, really hard, and they hit a metric that you know for sure they'll do well on their in-service exam, so you don't have to worry about them, and they compete to be a surgeon. Because if you look at that, I think we're missing lots of good surgeons by making them do that high test. But we do it. When I became a surgeon, we just had to pass that test. We finished med school on Thursday. Remember that? We took it on Friday. I got a 205, and nobody cared. So for me, having people check these boxes to maintain their certification really sort of goes along with everything else they do. So I actually think it's important to have recertification. Our patients really want us to be professional. They all want us to be up to date. They assume that. Patients now are consumers. And so when they're out there shopping for healthcare, which is what they're doing now, because there's so much financial commitment from patients. Last year at Wake Forest, we had $90 million of unpaid deductibles because people have such high deductibles now, and you probably have seen that in your practice as well. that really, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 deductible for you to operate on them, that they truly think that all of us are equal. They actually think the care at each place is equal, and they're just looking for a good deal, sort of like what you do on Amazon. You know what kind of product you want, and you keep looking for a price. Now, we all know that's not true, but for these patients who are consumers, again, these are not your underadvantaged patients. These are not patients who are immobile. These are the patients that will travel for care, maybe even go outside their state for care. They actually assume we're good. And one of the big worries I have is when they do go shopping and get a lower price, they won't. So for me, as an administrator and also in a community, I really want everybody to do this. So you want them to be recertified. You want them to have lifelong learning. You want some proof that these people who are doing procedures are really good. And I do think passing medical knowledge assessments and working on how to improve activities in your hospital are very important. Now, your hospital really knows who you are, right? I mean, they know if you're a good doctor or not. They know what your outcomes are. And most of us now know that we get evaluated and marched about outcomes. We have so many good tools now compared to 20 or 30 years ago when we really didn't even know if the operations worked, right? And we didn't really follow what happened. NISQIP was around when I first started looking at 30-day outcomes, and that was the first time we did it. So the hospital knows if you do all of these things as well. But the appropriateness, I think, is the other piece that patients really suffer a bit from. Because of people's enthusiasm to do intervention, and we all know there are surgeons like that, that intervention, sometimes the indication is breathing, that the patient comes in, you see them, and you get an intervention, that I think, is also the biggest thing about recertification, is to make sure you understand appropriateness, because all the procedures change, outcomes, new ideas about complications and where we're going. So I have just a couple studies, too, and frankly, I think the one thing I found is there's not much out there about surgical recertification. There's a little bit, but there's more in other fields, and I think one thing we could do as we go forward is really with this new type of MOC is to really look at those. We have a little bit about legal data that they showed us, but even some specific things I know as a vascular surgeon we could look at. So here is increased patient outcomes if you did have higher MOC scores. So, again, be competitive, that you had better performance, especially with chronic care and preventative services. And, again, for us who are running these big systems of care, this value-based care, which actually surgeons don't do a lot of it. We really want surgeons to do amazing operations and not really worry if someone has a flu shot or colonoscopy and that. We really want you to do that. But for those people in your practices or your groups who are doing a very good job of value-based care, that's where we're making the money now. We're really not making money on surgical procedures in the hospital. We're barely breaking even. But we made $32 million last year on our primary care group of 500 because they do this value-based and do all that, and they didn't spend all the money. And so we actually have money now to fuel my specialist. Talk about a different world, right? So you want them to do this, and you want them to be recertified. And again, it was mentioned before that board-certified emergency physicians don't miss MIs as much. So again, board certification is almost, I would never hire someone who's not board certified. And I also would never keep someone on staff who wasn't recertified. And this is another one, interventionalist, pediatric gastroenterologist, had improvement in the other part of our world that has changed, right? I remember installing timeouts at Hopkins back in 2004. I closed the OR for 2 days so people could learn how to do timeouts, and I saw Steve Yang walk, and he knew I did that. I made people not go to the OR, and the three or four physicians I had that were horrible in the OR refused to go to the training sessions. Again, they check all boxes. You know, if they're not behaving here, they're going to not behave in every box. And these, also, they're better with patients, communicating to primary care doctors and to patients. And again, patients are consumers now. They expect you to communicate. And we use an online thing, I'm sure all of you do, so you can communicate with your patients through the electronic medical record. I like it a lot, but my other barometer is my husband, who's non-medical. He loves going on his site and seeing his lab results and talking to his doc and all that. I think patients really enjoy having that communication and transparency. And again, another thing that people, they improve the percentage of patients with controlled blood pressure. And if you do look at the other thing that we need to do is to decrease the disease burden out there. Even though as a surgeon, I always worried there wouldn't be anything to do if everybody wasn't sick. But we need less sick people so that we can operate and get paid more for each procedure we do. And so we have money to make that happen. So if you look at the whole system, keeping healthy patients is good. So patients really do care about better outcomes. And not only will they find out you personally what you do, but they do look at price points now, and that is probably the number one thing they're looking at. Bankruptcy is the number one cause, healthcare cost is the number one cause of bankruptcy in the United States right now. And so patients really don't want to go bankrupt getting their care. And with the high deductibles, I'm in a non-Medicaid expansion state. It's really tough on patients. And we also, we did $200 million of uninsured care last year. And if you're in certain areas, you're doing that as well, too. And the one piece about this, too, is that patients really are looking for better outcomes. They want to know what you're going to do and how that's going to work with them. I think that the environment has changed so. So 10 years ago, when they asked people in the United States, do you think health care is a right? About 30% of us thought across the country health care is a right. Now if you ask us, 70% of us think it's a right. And that probably comes from the Medi-Cal expansion, Obamacare, access to care. Because I know as a surgeon, I always thought I did a great job, whether I was at the VA or county, I did the right procedure for the right person at the right time. But I didn't really think about all those people that never got into my clinic. And there's a lot of them. And so they care about outcomes, they care about price, they assume you're good. And I think as a leader, we need to make sure everybody out there is really good. And I think making sure you are recertified is good. And again, I it's this box thing. You know, I've been watching people practice for 20 years now. So does participation in MOC reflect a certain kind of physician you would want and not really improvement in care? And I think it goes hand in hand. You know, people that make sure they get their MOC done and make sure they do this, I think actually are the people that check all the good boxes, that are the ones that do the timeouts, that are the ones that are team sports, are the ones that really help improve what's going on in your hospital. So to me, I do think it's a marker of someone that wants to maintain the best you can be. And to me, even though those big exams, which I took, you know, three times in each, and I did let the board know that I did not need to do any more. I'm good to 2027 to do it. But I have done the every 2 years of CME is good. The other thing that's really hard, you know, I'm an academic physician, so I get CME dripping off of me every day. It's really hard in your private practice, and I now am in a rural environment. So having online things for surgeons to do is fabulous. And plus the new generation, why would they even go to a lecture? If you look at us, the average age here sitting is not young, okay? Maybe it's because it's MOC, but I think they're online somewhere. So I think having online tools, podcasts, all those kind of ways to do it. I did all my CSAP and VSAP online. It was great. I do think that getting CME ways that doesn't require you to leave town is amazing. There's a general surgeon that works with me in Wilkesboro. He's in a hospital, 70-bed hospital. He's been on call for 13 years as a solo surgeon. He's just amazing. John Thompson is his name. And I looked at him. I said, how could you possibly be on call for 13 years? Occasionally he goes on vacation. He goes, well, how could you possibly be a CEO? I couldn't even imagine doing that. And so everybody, we did find him a partner. So now he's on every other night, and he's just delighted. But he can't do that. And, you know, so making sure we have tools to do that. And these questions, I've gotten a lot of testimonial of these questions that we're doing are really great. And if you were sitting there, if you were sitting there needing surgery, which maybe some of you are, or if you were sitting there with your primary care doctor, what would you want them to do? We've had a great big symposium for about 6 months looking at the military and what to do with these amazingly trained surgeons that go into military and don't have a lot of surgery to do. And we're really worried about them because, you know, is a low-volume surgeon, especially a young surgeon, is that good, or can you? Is low volume versus high volume? And we argued back and forth. And number one is, if you needed to have an operation, would you choose a low-volume surgeon? And the answer is no. So why are we trying to justify it? Similar, if you had a surgeon, what would you want them to have done? You want to know their volumes, their outcomes, and you want to know that they're up to speed on everything that's going on and that they are a team player in the hospital, because there's no question they would do better. Both my parents have had surgery. My mother had an abdominal aortic aneurysm done with multiple complications at Hopkins. They got into her iliac vein, and she had a PE and a few other minor things and got through the whole thing. And my dad ended up having an amputation, and both of them have Asker diseases. I'm a vascular surgeon. And as I interacted with the surgeons who I handpicked, of course, because we're smart enough to know, boy, the demands I made, I wanted to watch my dad's cath. Well, why would I want to do that? I just want to know what it was. And, of course, they dissected one of his coronaries and had to put in 3 stents and all that. So I didn't want to see that. But I think as a family member, making sure that those people do the right things and looking at credentials to do it is really, really important to make that happen. And interpreting that for your family members, and many of you have, that you would want one of those surgeons that does check every single box. And so I think some sort of MOC that's easy, some sort of CME that's easy, ability to make that happen is really good. And if you can come to meetings, you know, we really do benefit from the camaraderie and interaction. The college is just fabulous for that. I've been coming to the college, you know, since 1983, and there's always something I can learn from this. And I think that's the other thing, is there's always something you can learn from this. And whether it's team training or information or not doing that operation anymore or doing it in a different way, or appropriateness. That's the thing that I think MOC helps us with. So thanks so much. Oh, I have one slide, too. We're all forgetting it's too early for us. So patients would like us to do MOC. There's no question. If you talk to them, and again, if you need to tell them what it is, and it shouldn't be onerous. You know, changes in the ABS, I think, are fabulous, what's going on with that to do it, and I'm not one to hold on to the way we did it forever. The other thing that's out there is artificial intelligence. So I went to this thing. So I think of artificial intelligence like a little R2-D2 that follows me around, but it's really probably going to be on your watch. So as you do the EMR, it will transcribe your note. They're doing this in London now, that the first doctor someone sees is a robot who goes through all the questions, and the robot's very friendly, very nice. Patients love it. And then they refer to a doctor online, and they make the diagnosis. And occasionally you'll see someone in person. But it really works. It's similar to telehealth and everything else. And it gets through all, and you don't have to have a scribe. You don't have to hire another nurse to do the review of systems. I mean, it's really great that this will be, I've been 3 years, we'll have this, and it will just save the world. And also we'll say, you know, Julie, I have 3 articles you can read on this, and I've read them, and here's the summary. Oh, Julie, did you know you had to sign your notes? Oh, Julie, would you like to look at this? This just came out in JAMA. It's something to do with you. It will actually make everything about that amazing. And it was scary, but I actually think, calling it augmented intelligence also, so you don't think artificial sort of. But I tell you, it's amazing. And Duke is trialing some of these, and it's just going to change the world. I had a third-year medical student ask me why we didn't have it yet at Wake, because I'm working on it. But you will have these devices and things that will make you really, really, really smart so that you can actually interact with your patient and be a good surgeon. Okay, thanks so much. I think I am done now. Here's references. Okay, great.